Hello, welcome to the Conflict Skills Podcast. I'm your host, professional mediator Simon Good. In this podcast, I provide free resources and tools for dealing with conflict. So if that's something that you're interested in, whether it's additional strategies and tools in your toolkit for dealing with work challenges like difficult clients or difficult colleagues, difficult bosses, for example, or dealing with conflict on the personal front, please consider pressing subscribe. The topic of the podcast today is talking about conflict with roommates or conflict with housemates, as I've said, and I have to say that I was putting together and preparing this podcast, I experienced what I sometimes call small T trauma. It's what probably is not going to result in a PTSD type of symptom coming up, but nevertheless, I certainly do experience very elevated levels of stress and emotion remembering different situations that I've been in. So obviously there are some difficult feelings that are still sitting there for me, and probably it has also contributed to my own conditioning, like my own programming. I mean, now looking back on all of those situations, I realize that actually I had contributed to most of the suffering that I experienced far more than I realized at the time. And to be honest, I probably had a number of different options for managing with many different situations differently. And so I've prepared this podcast looking at three different areas in the hope that they'll be useful for you if you're experiencing challenges in conflict with the people that you live with. So at the beginning, I'll talk about how I think about the process of conflict resolution versus conflict escalation or conflict interaction. You know, it's like things become more stuck or things might become more constructive. Next, I'll explain the five different kinds of conflict, a topic that I've discussed previously, but here I'll be applying it specifically to conflict with people that you live with your housemates or your roommates. And then finally, I'll talk through some options for discussing issues with your roommates or with your housemates, managing those types of difficult conversations. So I'll talk about how to flag a topic in a mutual and neutral way. Gosh, I always get tongue-tied trying to say that. How to raise issues and what you might need to prepare for, which, to be honest, is probably a knee-jerk reaction from the other person if it's the first time that you're raising an issue and it's likely that they might at least initially become quite defensive, right? I mean, it's often the way that these types of conversations play out is that we go in with good intentions, we do our best to talk it through like adults. You know, I often hear these phrases, shouldn't we be able to discuss this like adults, or it's just common sense, you know, shouldn't we just be able to be reasonable and have a rational conversation? And I'm constantly saying to people when I'm running conflict resolution training, I mean, I don't know, have you met any people? Where did you get the idea from that there's such a thing as common sense or that you're able to talk things through like adults? Nobody seems able to do this. If we look around, there's conflict within families and workplaces are just rife with conflict. It's one of the reasons why as a mediator, I can honestly say that our business has never been busier. Not that I necessarily at all think that that's a good thing. I see many people suffering at a very profound and deep level because of ongoing workplace conflict in particular, let alone divorce and separation and people being cut off from their family and all the rest of it. So no, people aren't able to have an adult-to-adult conversation. And so if your expectation is that that will be possible or that it will always be possible, well, guess what? You're probably going to be disappointed. So realistically, what we're probably doing at the end of that type of a conversation is clarifying expectations. You could start with empathy and engagement and collaborating and discussing options, but particularly if they're roommates that you don't know very well and like maybe you've already decided that you're not going to want to be friends with them or have much to do with them moving forward, well, then probably for you, it might be more about setting up boundaries. So I'll talk about that gradual transition from being a little bit more supportive or open or empathetic or flexible or however you might say that, like caring more about what they want and what they need, to focusing a little bit more on what you want and what you need as a priority, at least prioritizing it in the mix of the different factors that you consider, so that you're not always slipping into accommodator rescuer mode in an effort to try and keep the other people happy. Now, before we get into those topics, I just wanted to flag that if you're experiencing a particularly high level of stress when you're dealing with conflict with your roommates, you're not alone. It's a uniquely challenging situation to be in. And part of the reason for this is that you never get any breathing space. You never get any time out. if there's conflict going on with the people around you, you probably become reminded of it and to some extent re-experience it so frequently through the day, every time you go out to get a drink or every time you arrive home or packing your stuff and putting it near the front door and you're thinking about what your housemate might think about that and whether they're going to get angry about you leaving a mess or something. It's a constant re-triggering of our stress response, the fight or flight response, the sympathetic nervous system, which is a ramping up in escalation in our body. It's a higher level of just physically blood pressure and blood sugar and heart rate, etc. And so if you're feeling like you're always on edge or uptight and you just can't fully unwind and can't switch off, if you're dealing with conflict with your roommates, that might be one of the most significant factors that's contributing to that. And so whatever you decide to do with the people that you live with, one of the things that I often suggest is also to take this as an opportunity for self-care. Think through what do you need to look after yourself and do it. Because if you're working from a deficit and you're going into a challenging conversation at an 8 out of 10 level of stress, well, that's not going to be a recipe for things being productive and being able to focus on the future and the solutions. What, of course, will happen is that you'll get stuck on all of the old patterns and focus on the past and the problems and the blame game back and forth. There's a saying I quite like, if you always do what you've always done, then you'll always get what you've already got. And so I think in terms of self-care, and if you're feeling like you're at risk of burnout and heading in that direction, then that hopefully is a little bit of a wake-up call. And this could be an opportunity to experiment with something different. So the first topic that I wanted to discuss is the overall process of how we think about conflict resolution with our housemates or with our roommates. In reality, the relationship between the two of you is something that is purely intangible. It is entirely subjective. You have come up with this idea of a relationship and what you think the relationship between you is, based entirely on your own beliefs and ideas and subjective opinions and limited perception and, you know, your conditioning and the way that you've been brought up and all of that kind of thing. There's no such thing as, you know, a true factual summary of a relationship. All you've really got is each of your different perspectives on what the relationship is, which means that you never actually have the same relationship with somebody as they have with you. In a sense, you've probably both got slightly different takes on the relationship between the two of you. So as you go into this, I guess, process of dealing with conflict with people that you live with your roommates or housemates, I think the helpful perspective to take in is to be quite open. It's to understand that whatever the challenges are and whatever the stresses and whatever the expectations and norms that you bring are yours. It's not necessarily something that's true or universal. Of course, you can say, this is how I'd like things to be. And you might do that more directly in some situations. If it's your house and you're renting out a room, maybe you're quite assertive and you say, these are the rules for the house. In other situations, if you've moved in with a friend and you don't want to end up losing the friendship, then you'd probably tread a little bit more gently. But what I'm saying is that we think about expressing our perspective as a request. It's, I guess, looking for clarification and clarifying expectations and getting on the same page where possible, and then exploring the other person's perspective, both on what's happened as well as what they want moving forward. For me, there is a reasonably common set of steps that often happen in the process of relationships improving and the conflict lessening. And what they tend to be are self-awareness. So in the beginning, I think if you're stuck and you're dealing with conflict with your roommates, the thing that you should probably be focusing on is that self-awareness layer. How is the conflict affecting you? How are you traveling? How is your stress, for example, your mismatch of expectations between the two of you, some of the external challenges that you're facing outside of the house, like financial challenges, for example? How are all of those things influencing your perspective? How are they influencing your perception and what you're focusing on and what's standing out to you? In what ways are you a little bit hypervigilant about some of the things that the other person's doing? And if they were going to change, what do you actually want? It's very easy to get stuck ruminating and over-focusing, I think, on some of the negative aspects of what the other person's doing, like they're not fair or they're always thinking of themselves or they think they can walk all over the top of me or it's always one-sided or whatever. And I suppose that might be true in a sense, but what else? Is it always like that or are there particular things that they tend to act in that way? Like do they eat all of your food and drink that's left in the fridge or when they've been drinking, are they particularly vulgar in the language that they use? Or have you noticed that it tends to be when they're under the pump at work that they leave a lot more mess around the house? It's just gaining a little bit more perspective. And I would start with you, the self-awareness part. And then before you even do any kind of analysis or reflection on the other person, I would then focus on self-regulation. Do everything that you can do to manage the stress of the conflict in the short term, because if this relationship is going to be able to improve, what is needed is that you don't make it worse. The other person's probably not going to change quickly. Let's hope that they do start to improve, but usually it's a gradual process. And so what that means is that you'll need to find a way to bite your tongue, to suck it up, to tolerate negative behaviors, to be a little bit more patient, a little bit more forgiving, find the right balance between compassion and, you know, sympathy with wisdom and needing to also make sure that you're not setting up a dynamic where it is effectively abusive. If the other person has unrealistic expectations, then you're going to need to deal with that at some stage. But where possible, you should look at what you need and what you can do to fill yourself up before coming to the other person. The reason for this is that often the things that push our buttons and upset us the most in conflict is it is almost like a signal about something that we're lacking. If my son, who's 7, calls me an idiot and a dumb head or something, it doesn't really hurt my feelings, you know, because I don't rely on his, the way that he talks to me, as a contributing factor to my self-esteem. I do look at the way he looks at me and I want him to be proud of me and look up to me and I want to have a connection. And there are factors that I'm focused on, but the things that he says about me, I say it with a grain of salt. He's 7. He's, the rational bit of his brain is nowhere near fully developed yet. So I think it would be a mistake for me to overreact when he's rude. But that's not because of him. That's because of me. If I was a less regulated kind of person, if I had had no sleep, if I was really drunk, if I was fuming and angry and I just had a car accident and, you know, I was hurt and in a panic, or I just got an email from my boss saying that I was fired and I've lost my job and, you know, it was already the kind of situation where I was really unbalanced, well, then I might snap at him and say, "You're an idiot." I don't think I probably would say that, but do you know what I mean? We reciprocate when we're at our worst. And so that's why I think the self-regulation is so important, because it effectively becomes a buffer that you can use to not react when the other person does or says something. From there, I think you look at a gradual process of transitioning from being empathetic and focusing on connection. So at the beginning, if things are tricky with your roommate, maybe you would say, "Hey, it feels like there's a bit of tension between the two of us. I'd love a chance to touch base. The last thing I want is for things to get worse. And, you know, I actually wonder if maybe there's a lot of stress that we're both dealing with outside of the house at the moment. Maybe we don't need to have a long, deep and meaningful about it, but probably it would be helpful for me just to get on the same page about food or housework over the next few weeks. Have you got a minute later today?" It's sort of that empathy, like, how are you traveling? What's your take on this situation? How are you finding things? And being very open and a higher level of focus, I think, on the other person's perspective. And then if things don't change, if they continue to do the wrong thing, particularly if they've promised to your face that they're going to change, but then they go away and still don't do it, well, then I think the focus must become more about assertiveness. It's boundaries, clarifying expectations, talking to them about the consequence. If this happens again, this is what will happen. It's like, if this happens again, this is the consequence. If you're late on your rent again, I'm going to need to give you a written warning. And then ultimately giving an ultimatum. This is your last chance. This is the final straw. This is the last opportunity to change. And if it does happen, then this is the better consequence for you. And if it doesn't, this is the more negative consequence. The next tool that I think is often particularly helpful when you're dealing with conflict with your roommates is understanding the five different types of conflict: relationship, data, structure, interest, and values. So relationship conflict, data conflict, structural conflict, or conflict related to structure, interest, and values. Now, relationship conflict is often the tip of the iceberg, and when you're dealing with conflict with your housemates, it's probably the most obvious kind of conflict that you're dealing with. It's the tension between the two of you, the dynamics, the unspoken messages, the, you know, subtle grunts or noises or body language or facial expressions or pausing before you respond or trying to stay calm but doing it in a way that obviously you're gritting your teeth because you're so angry and you can't stay calm. This is relationship conflict. It develops between the two of you, and if you'd like it to change, often the solution is thinking about what might have caused it and doing the opposite. If you've both been in the house a lot lately and walking on each other's toes and just kind of rubbing each other up the wrong way, maybe having some time apart would be really helpful. If there's a chaotic kind of environment and there's no structure, so everybody's coming and going at different times and there's no rules around bills or purchasing stuff for the house or whatever, then maybe clarifying and adding a little bit more routine and structure would be something that's helpful. But in most kind of conflict resolution training that I do, I often suggest that it can be helpful to leave that relationship conflict type until last, because there's no point going out for lunch or having a beer or sitting down and having a cup of coffee or whatever you do with your housemates. It might be something a lot more extreme, or maybe it's nothing like that. But you want to focus on the relationship mending type of stuff, like how you're traveling, you know, how's work been lately. That's not going to make any benefit if the underlying problem is that you've both got a different idea about how the bills should be split within the house, and that's what's driving the conflict. So let's look at that type of conflict next, which is what you might call data conflict. This is things like, it might be the understanding about finances, like who contributes what, how acceptable is it to be late with your rent? If somebody can't pay rent, is it sort of accepted that somebody else would step in and pay it for them? So where this is data conflict, it's coming about because there's a difference in expectations. I think this was going to happen and you think something else was going to happen. Or I think that this should happen and you think that something else should happen. Now again, it's not necessarily as should as people tend to think. It's probably a lot more subjective than you realize. But this is what we're dealing with if we're going to resolve data conflict. It's to get on the same page about those expectations. So, hey, I want to touch base about finances. It seems like your perspective is this, whereas I was thinking this. I mean, ultimately, I suppose we could go with either option, or maybe there's something else we can come up with. Could we organize a time to go through it together? See if we can come up with something that works for both of us. What do you reckon? So you could do that more formally, an email back and forth, for example. In some relationships, that would be appropriate. In other situations, you just sit down and do it less formally. I do wonder, though, if maybe in some situations where data conflict has contributed to enough of the conflict that you've needed to do something about it, it might be worth keeping some kind of a record. I don't know what you think, but it's a dilemma when you're working with housemates and roommates, because especially if you're friends or you're young, you might not want to have things really formal, and you know, you don't want to get out a written contract about how much you're each going to contribute to the, I don't know, like budget for toilet cleaning supplies in the house or something. But on the other end, if there's nothing written down, then it does open the door for misunderstandings down the track. And so I think sometimes just having a brief outline in an email, for example, hey, just making sure I've captured what we talked about today, let me know if I've got anything wrong. Just want to make sure we're on the same page, and I really appreciate all of your efforts and willingness to listen and go through some of this. I know it can be tedious. So keeping some kind of a record, it means that if that data conflict comes up in the future, you've got that reference to go back and use. So I personally think that that's probably a helpful step to take, but for me, I also tend to do it where possible in a way that lowers the stakes. I don't want the other person to experience it as pressure or me trying to push them around, because of course that will be the kind of thing that triggers defensiveness and resistance on their end. The next kind of conflict that you might come across is structure, structural conflict. This could be a lack of structure, or it might just be that you've got the wrong structure in place. And I think a lot of different areas of conflict with your roommates come about because of a lack of structure or not enough structure. You might have an assumption about the fact that everybody will chip in around cleaning and those kind of tasks. Or maybe you've only got one fridge that you're all sharing within the house. And, you know, I lived in Korea for a couple of years and my wife eats kimchi a lot, which is one of the Korean foods that's particularly stinky. And to be honest, it can stink up the fridge pretty badly. And so maybe a structural option for resolving conflict around kimchi in a share mate kind of fridge is have your own fridge in your room, or have a fridge in the garage that's used for particularly smelly foods or something like that. Putting a structure or routine in place around jobs and household responsibilities. Coming up with a common bank account that you'll each have an automatic amount of money transferred into each month that then you can use for the incidental kind of expenses around the house. It's just thinking about all of these different options for structure, how bills are paid, for example, and where that's been contributing to conflict. You might be surprised at how this can significantly shift a situation without actually needing to do a whole lot else. If there's been problems because you're paying rent in a way that includes food and something else at the moment, and the owner of the house is getting annoyed that you're eating so much, or you feel like you're uncomfortable and you can't just go in and get food when you want to. I experienced that myself in my first share house. I was paying rent and it included food and electricity and internet and stuff. Or I'm not even sure if we paid for internet back then. That's how long ago that was. But I always felt guilty going into the fridge and getting more food. You know, we had four people that lived in the house, because I wasn't exactly sure whether they were planning to come and eat that leftover food, or whether the expectation was that we would all get an equal portion of all of the different foods, if you know what I mean. Or the idea was that you would kind of take what you wanted and it was just first in, best dressed. Like, we never discussed any of this. And so that, in a sense, could be data conflict. Like, we didn't discuss the rules, so to speak, which made me, of course, feel like I might be breaking the rules because I didn't know. And on the other side, they might have been quite annoyed about the fact that I was nibbling every single food in the fridge rather than just eating a whole serving of something. But to be honest, I think the way that new flatmates and new housemates were brought in was the thing that contributed to the problem. If they had some type of a cheat sheet or document on the fridge that explained the expectations, or they sat down with us as a group, or maybe we had a quick meeting where we could have a beer and talk things through in the house once a month, then all of those options would have solved that problem. If we had a regular meeting, then I could have asked them, hey, what do you want to do about food? You know, are you guys just eating what you want, or do you tend to prefer just to, you know, buy your own or have particular meals set aside, or do you want to put your name on things in the fridge that you want? Like, you know, what's going to work for you? But we never had a meeting. So the conflict wasn't necessarily to do with just the food. It was the underlying structure, if that makes any sense. So if you're wanting to deal with conflict with your housemates at that structural level, what I would encourage you to do is to consider options for adding structure or changing existing structures where possible. And of course, a lot of this is done through discussion and collaboration with the other people that are involved. The next kind of conflict that you might come across is interest conflict. This is like, I want something and you want something else, and we're not going to both be able to get what we want. There's three beers left in the fridge and there's two of us, so one of us is going to get two beers and one of us is going to get one. Or maybe I'll get three and you'll get none, or you'll drink the beer before I realize that it's in the fridge. And the challenge with this type of interest conflict is that in many situations, there's no magic wand that you can wave to solve the problem. There are three beers and you're both thirsty. Sometimes you've got other money that you can draw from. You can collaborate. You know, if you give me these three beers, I'll buy you a six pack tomorrow or something. Like, in some situations, there is that type of a win-win option. But I think most of the time you're actually looking at either a compromise, like meeting in the middle, or accommodating, which is giving in and keeping the other person happy, or competing, being assertive and looking after your own needs, drinking the beer before your housemate gets home. The best way to deal with this type of interest conflict, I think, is to consider your goals. How important is the relationship with your housemate? How thirsty are you? What are the chances of other beer coming later? Do you like this particular type of beer? Is there another situation where you're going to need to ask your flatmate for a favour later on in the week? Maybe it's better to keep in their good books at the moment. Maybe they've been a bit selfish and drunk your beer last time it was in the fridge, so to you this seems like perfectly fair enough, and actually it would be a situation where I can show them that they can't walk all over the top of me. We need to pause, and I guess the thing is that we want to respond strategically rather than taking some type of a knee-jerk reaction, which is what often happens when you're in the middle of interest conflict. It might be that you don't have a beer because you're worried about causing conflict and so you just want to avoid it. Or maybe you're the kind of person that does go in and get all three of them and take them to your room so that nobody else has a chance to drink them from underneath you. The final type of conflict is what you might call values conflict. Now, these are fluid and subjective, but they might be the kind of values that we hold for a very long period of time. Maybe one housemate really values environmental sustainability, for example, so they might want to buy cleaning products that don't have particular kinds of chemicals. Somebody else in the house might not particularly care. They just want to minimize costs on cleaning supplies so that probably they can have more than three beers in the fridge. And each of these values, like whether you're wanting to focus on the economics or the environmental sustainability, it's possible to think about them both as being equally valid, you know. Arguably, you might think one is right and one is wrong, or we should focus on this rather than this. But that should is probably a lot more subjective than most people realize. So when we're dealing with values conflict, one of the things that can be really helpful is just to add nuance. When people often go into conflict around these kind of issues, it's often a very black and white perspective that they bring. I've noticed with housemates and roommates in particular lately, over the past few years, it tends to be a lot more related to values conflict. You hear a housemate, you know, using the N-word or something like that, or listening to particular podcasts or YouTube channels or influencers on Instagram or something, or they're criticizing you about the way that you look, or they're all of a sudden, you know, pushing a particular barrier around. They're an activist for this particular cause all of a sudden, and they're incredibly upset and can't believe the fact that you seem so heartless so as not to care about it. All of these things are values conflict, and I mean, I suppose we can navigate and discuss some of this to some extent. It seems like this particular cause is really important for you. Can you walk me through what you're thinking there? Okay, so it sounds like for you it's really about justice or helping people who need help or something like that. Like, you might be able to find some common ground underneath it in terms of their motivation. Like, why are they doing the thing that they are, or why do they care about the thing that they care about? But to be honest, I think when you're coming up with conflict with your roommates or housemates, one of the best options for dealing with values conflict is simply to focus on the behavior. I actually wonder if in many, many situations you don't actually need to agree on these underlying values as much as you might think that you do. I can't possibly be friends with somebody who does this or thinks this or uses this word or won't put up this kind of flag or whatever it is. It's like, I mean, that's fine. Obviously, that's something that's important to you and you're allowed to decide what's important. But why on earth do I need to think exactly the same as you do? And even if you're convinced that I do think the same as you do, I probably have a slight nuance in my perspective or my understanding or a limitation in my rational processing or my base knowledge or whatever, which means that I don't really agree with you 100%. And so for me, coming up with an agreement around values is probably not that essential. But what you do need to do is to make sure that you're on the same page in terms of behaviors. So if you've noticed your flatmate has a particular book that has an offensive title and you find it, you know, really troubling, and for you this is something that feels like even like a personal attack, and it's made you question whether or not you actually know this person. But for them, their value might be something that's completely different. They're looking at the language in the title of that book and thinking about it as kind of a collector's edition because the author is famous and they've written a number of other works that the person really loves. Well, do you need to get on the same page about the values, you know, of whether or not you should have a collector's book that has an offensive word in the title, even if it's rare and it's first edition or something? Or maybe you can just focus on the behavior, which would be look, you know, I appreciate where you're coming from and the fact that that book for you is something that's important. For me, I find myself being affected though when I have to see it. Would you mind keeping it in your room? So finally, let's think through some options for discussing issues with your roommates, managing difficult conversations. So the first thing that we should probably think about is how do we actually raise the topic? Generally speaking, it can be helpful to flag issues in a way that's mutual and neutral. So instead of saying something like, you're always leaving your junk all over the house, or I'm so sick of you just expecting me to cover you when you're short on the bills or short on the rent, maybe saying something like, hey, I'd love a chance to touch base about how things are going in the house. Are you free tomorrow morning? Maybe we could grab a coffee. So we're flagging, I'd like to talk about how things are in the house, or I'd like to talk about how things are between us, or I'd like to talk about finances, or I'm wondering if we could get on the same page about jobs and household responsibilities. So that's neutral. I'm not saying I want to talk to you because I'm sick of the fact that you treat me like I'm your parent. I'm saying the neutral thing is jobs or shopping or money or something. Could we talk about that topic? Bill Eddy provides some good advice in how to raise issues when he talks about strategies for dealing with high conflict personalities. Raising the issue in a way that's brief, informative, friendly or respectful, and firm. So if the challenge is that they've been not paying their rent and they've been late, just saying something like, look, this is the third time this year that you've been at least a week or two late on your rent. So it's factual. There's three times and this is what's happened. I'm not saying obviously you're not taking it seriously or you expect other people to come in and fix your problems for you. I'm sick of you being the victim. I say this is the third time that you've missed the deadline on paying rent. Respectful or friendly, I suppose we want to do it in a way that assumes that they're not a jerk and they're not an idiot. So we could say something like, look, I don't know what else is going on for you at the moment. I know you've been going through some challenges on the work front, or I know that at the moment with the costs of inflation, financial pressures are probably higher than they have been historically. At the same time, I'm not able to cover you. So it's important that we're both contributing to our share of the rent each month on the due date. Is that going to be possible? So I don't assume that you're a jerk or that you're an idiot, but in my tone as well as the contents of what I talk about, I adopt a firm stance. So there are things that need to change. I wanted to flag this because it's not working. This is something that I'd like to propose and I have limited flexibility on it. So I can still do it in a respectful way, but what I don't want to do is to give the other person the impression that they'll be able to walk all over the top of me. I almost want to hold on to some of my ammunition until later. At the beginning, I do want to be friendly and respectful, but what I don't want to do is to completely minimize the issue to such an extent that the other person doesn't take it seriously. So we would flag the topic in that mutual and neutral way, raise the issue in a way that's brief, informative, friendly, and firm if possible. The next step, I think, in a lot of different conflict situations is preparing for a reaction. Now, this might be a pretty strong reaction if you're raising an issue that the other person's already quite upset about. Or maybe it will be shock and surprise and acting indignant and how dare you, and they might accuse you of overreacting and creating a mountain out of a molehill or something. I suppose ultimately you're not actually responsible for their reaction, and although you might be able to predict that they will react, sometimes it's challenging to know exactly what they're actually going to do. So broadly speaking, I focus on preparing to keep myself calm. So I have my self-regulation tools ready, like the breathing techniques or making sure I'm in the right headspace before I go in, or your mindfulness exercises. Then I prepare for de-escalation and empathy. So I might think through some of the factors that the other person needs, like I'll give them a chance to let off steam for a little while. I'll give them a chance to vent and blow up because that tends to be the way that they communicate. It's that moment where it's like with a child and all of the toys are out of the cot and they're having a tantrum. But then what tends to happen is that as that passes, they might slow down and become more open to my input. And there I might decide to share more about my feelings. Whereas earlier on when they were seeing red, they probably didn't have much capacity to be aware of what was going on for other people. So I'm not judging that. I certainly don't think that that's okay or right or it's my job to fix it. But if this is somebody that I live with, most of the time I don't want a horrible, awkward, tense relationship. I would prefer things to just be okay. I ideally probably want things to be friendly, and I'd like to have a warm relationship with the people that I live with personally. But at the least, I think what we don't want is stress. So we prepare for de-escalation and empathy, knowing that the other person will probably react initially, not just to do with what we've said and not just to do with us, but also to do with the other things that's going on for them that day and that week and that month and all the rest of it. And if you can be genuine and say, look, I know this is a lot to take in, or okay, it sounds like you've got quite a different perspective than me on this one. Oh gosh, all right, it sounds like some of those challenges that I've been going through weren't actually things that you were aware of until this point. So we empathize and normalize it and say, yeah, okay, look, all right, I'm realizing that we've actually got pretty different perspectives on all of this. And then I ask a question like, what would help to get on the same page moving forward? I think after we've done the de-escalation and empathy, that's often a really helpful point to either expand so we can go up a level and look at the pattern. Actually, I'm wondering if maybe a similar kind of thing was happening back when we ended up in that last fight last Christmas. What do you think? It might have been that you also felt like I was not pulling my weight and you had to do more than your fair share. And at the time, I remember I was looking after my mum who was sick, but we didn't have much chance to communicate about that. So you probably wouldn't have been aware of that. And I'm guessing from your perspective, it probably felt quite unfair. So we could circle back to the pattern and think through, hey, I wonder how what's going on at the moment is connected to something before. Or I wonder if this thing that's playing out between the two of us is actually connected to something else that's going on, like work pressures that we're both dealing with at the moment. And then we can also shift the conversation towards the future and the solutions. So given all of that, what do you think would help? Now, this doesn't necessarily all happen in a single conversation. This might be over the process of a few different conversations over a week or two in some situations. I think, though, if you're able to manage the de-escalation and the empathy well, though, there's a pretty high chance that at the very least you'll be able to, I guess, let off some of the steam and decrease some of the pressure. And when you're dealing with conflict with your housemates, that's often an incredibly helpful step, at least in the short term, so that you can clear the air a little bit, give yourself both some breathing space, and open the door for things to begin to improve moving forward. So I hope that that has been helpful for you, thinking about some of those different areas of tools for dealing with conflict with your roommates or housemates. Again, if you're interested in other resources and tools for dealing with conflict similar to this topic today, maybe focused on workplace situations, for example, or other personal relationship challenges that you might come across, please consider subscribing. And if the content that I've talked about in the session has been helpful for you today in the podcast, I'm so used to saying the session because most of my days spent running training workshops and training sessions. Anyway, if it's been helpful for you, I'd really appreciate if you would leave a positive review. For a tiny little podcast like this, it's an incredibly helpful cue to the algorithm, just that other people might also be interested in the kind of resources that I'm aiming to develop and provide. Thank you again for listening, and all the best managing your conflict, particularly if you are dealing with conflict with your own roommate or housemate at the moment. Bye for now.